Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 107 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Today I'm speaking with Rory Cormack. Rory is a professor of international relations at the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom, specializing in secret intelligence and covert action. He's also given presentations at No. 10 Downing Street, the UK Ministry of Defense, the US State Department, and the Pentagon. Besides his work teaching, he's written 5 books focusing on British history, covert action, and statecraft. I invited Rory onto the podcast today to discuss his book, Disrupt and Deny: Spies, Special Forces, and the Secret Pursuit of British Foreign Policy. It's an amazingly in-depth look at British covert activities in the post-World War II era. But before we get into that discussion, I want to say a big thank you to everyone listening who is also supporting me on Patreon, including James H. and Brian A. Your monthly contributions there help me keep this podcast going week in and week out. As a way of thanking my patrons, I offer a lot of great freebies and promotions, including free and discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. Patrons also get exclusive access to long-form articles of mine that aren't available anywhere else. If you haven't signed up for my Patreon yet, but you want to, just click the link in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening to right now. Rory, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thanks so much for inviting me. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. I'm really excited for this topic because I know so little, honestly, about British covert activities during this period compared to the U.S. intelligence community. And it seems to me like information on American operations has been far more accessible than that of your own government.
That is very true. I'm not going to argue that in the slightest. It's very, very difficult, really, to track this stuff down. I mean, all of MI6 documents are classified post-1949, really. GCHQ documents are classified. So what we have to do, we have to become, you know, intrepid historians, if you like, and go on the archival trail to find little snippets and pieces of the puzzle that we can stitch together. And so whether that's weirdly going to the US to find US presidential archives, because the Americans declassify so much more than we do, to find things about British history, or looking in parallel files in the British government archives. For example, I like to tell my students to follow the money, and I found some wonderful documents about MI6 top secret slush funds and bribery operations, which unsurprisingly were not in MI6 files. They were in Treasury files.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, that really just reminds me of something. I interviewed an author named Giles Milton, who you might be familiar with, a while back. And he told me that he found some documents in India that had been declassified by the Indian government, which the British government had not declassified yet. So that was a real treasure trove for his book as well. So it's funny that you have to go outside of the country to find documents on your own government's activities during that time period. But if it works, it works.
Yeah, and you also get to do the great American Presidential Archive Trail and go to some pretty cool towns like Abilene, Kansas, and Missouri and places. It's good fun.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. So aside from that, did you have any other kind of like unusual tricks you had to use to track all of this down? Because it was, like I said, it's very thorough, in my opinion, the most thorough look at these activities that I've seen yet. And I was kind of shocked to find out how much you had uncovered.
Thanks. I think, to be honest, I think some kind of former intelligence practitioners are shocked at how much is actually out there. And there is more out there than people realize if you are intrepid and if you hunt down. Another of my kind of favorite stories along these lines was you have to go to small little archives and put in lots of legwork. And then you might find the odd bit that might be surprising. For example, I was in the Birmingham University Library and I was reading the memoirs, the diary of a guy called Evelyn Shuckburgh, who was a senior diplomat in Foreign Office diplomat specializing in the Middle East in the 1950s. Now, Shugborough had written a book. He'd published his memoirs on Suez and all the shenanigans around that. And, you know, one could read the book. I, however, decided, well, seemingly foolishly, but actually it was a moment of genius, accidental genius, to go down to Birmingham and look at the raw memoirs of this to see if anything had been cut from the published book. And there, in July 1955, wherever it was, there was a description of his discussion with Her Majesty the Queen, talking about covert operations in the Middle East, no less, with this wonderful line that the Queen was talking, they were talking about a particular Middle Eastern leader who was operating against British interests. And the Queen looks at Shugborough and she says, "Has nobody thought of slipping something in his coffee?" And that was not, unsurprisingly, in the published version of those memoirs.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I can see why they would remove that before publication. My goodness. There it is in print. You found it. Fascinating stuff. And I do recall, I don't remember actually the specifics of it from your book since it's been a few weeks, but I know that there was one operation that you very briefly covered in the book. And I think that the sole evidence that you could find of it was four words written, like a four-word handwritten notation in the minutes of a meeting, something like that. And that was the only written evidence of this specific operation. Do you recall the one I'm talking about right now?
I do. It's ridiculous, isn't it? This was that treasury file I mentioned a moment ago.
Okay,
completely super classified, and they are bean counting the numbers spent on these various operations. And they had code words. Operation Razzle was one, a bunch of things which there was no reference to anywhere in the secondary literature, in the archives, because they're classified. So that's all I have. And can you imagine the frustration of a historian? You have this Operation Razzle. I have no idea what it is, no way of finding out. And then I managed to find literally four pencil written words to give a bit of a clue. And that's what we have to go on. It's crazy, but it's fun. I enjoy the challenge, put it that way.
I bet I understand that sentiment completely. There's so many stories here that I've covered or that, you know, I've spoken to someone about, and there's so much of it like, well, I guess we'll never really know the truth of that, you know, and you kind of have to move on, just no matter how much you don't want to, but you have to kind of move forward no matter what.
It's true. But I think there's operational details of things that, you know, we will struggle and maybe never know the full story. But I think, certainly on the American side, but also on the British side, there's enough out there now for us to be able to give the big picture, give the sweep, the contours of covert action, what states were doing, what they weren't doing, why they were doing it, those kind of big questions. There's more than enough out there. And there is actually increasing amounts of operational detail being released into the British archives right now on forgeries and black propaganda and fronts and all that kind of thing. But that's a question for a future book, perhaps.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. There's always more to learn. So, Roy, can we just go back to the beginning of your story? Now, here on the podcast and in many books, you know, we've covered quite a bit the story of special operations during World War II, and I love that, but your book kind of starts mostly at the end of World War II. So can you talk a little bit about how these organizations changed or grew in the immediate aftermath of the end of the war in Europe?
Yeah, it's the Special Operations Executive, isn't it? There's the famous wartime sabotage operation, you know, what's the quote? Setting Europe ablaze. And they get disbanded in 1946, soon after the end of the war, because the world has changed and the Brits are quite hesitant about some of this type of thing. They think, well, it's justified in total war against the Nazis, who are trying to, it's an existential crisis, isn't it, in World War II? We're being on the cusp of being invaded. This stuff is justified. In the initial peace and then an easy peace, post-war, the diplomats in the Foreign Office are thinking, this isn't very British. Bribery, sabotage, subversion, propaganda, we shouldn't really be doing this. And there's this big debate about the role of special operations, of covert activity in peacetime. And eventually, SOE gets cut. MI6, Special Special the Secret Intelligence Service gets given the rump capabilities, if you like, of SOE, but with a all important Foreign Office veto on its activities. And so the immediate post-war years are full of caution, they're full of restraint, and most British covert activities are geared towards planning for a future war. So things like setting up potential resistance networks to operate behind enemy lines in case of war. We're not talking about peacetime sabotage or anything like that. The Foreign Office were quite strict in the very immediate post-war world, much to the frustration, it should be said, of the British military, who were quite up for this and were much more gung-ho.
Yeah, that's certainly understandable. I mean, they had clearly seen the benefits of this kind of direct action because they had used that to win, I would say, and then to have all of that tamped down. Was everyone already by this period, like 1946, were they already looking to the Soviet Union as the next great threat, or did that take a little bit longer, do you think?
Took a bit of time. The military were there. The Foreign Office were a bit more cautious about designating, about recognizing the existence of a Cold War with all the threats that came with it. And there was a bit of internal division within the British intelligence world. But gradually, you know, 46, 47, 48, they came round to the conclusion that we are in a Cold War, that we are fighting an adversary hell-bent on domination, and also fighting an adversary who is not afraid to use dirty tricks of their own. And there's this big debate within British circles about whether Britain should essentially fight fire with fire. And there's a lovely quote that I came across from 46 or 47 or something. And it was a diplomat who wanted to be doing more of this. And he said, we should remember, we are wrestling with a tiger, not debating with a professor of epistemology.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I guess people saw the in terms of conflict rather than statecraft, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and it blurred the lines, didn't it, between diplomacy and military, and we're talking about Cold War, and the military say, well, hey, we're talking about war. It might be a Cold War, but we're talking about war. And therefore, right, we, the military, need to be involved in this, and we need to be doing more stuff. And the Foreign Office are much more cautious, and you see a lot of bureaucratic wrangling and all this kind of thing. And I know committees are not generally regarded as the sexiest historical subject, but let me tell you this one, see if I can change listeners' minds. There was a super top secret committee that the Foreign Office ran, and the military were constantly banging on the door, or sitting on the door, they didn't know it existed. So they were saying, we need to do more of this, we need to do more of this, we need to do more of this. And the Foreign Office eventually tell the military that this committee exists and let the military come and take a seat at this table to do the covert action planning for the Cold War. But as soon as they let the military in, those wily diplomats created a new, even more super secret committee to take the actual decisions, and just turned the initial committee into a talking shop and a place for the military to vent and to whinge. And they kept on doing that. Every time the military found out or got wind of a new body to do covert action, those canny diplomats would just create a new one and not tell the military.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is interesting. I hadn't considered that now, but you're right. You did seem to strike gold quite a bit with the committee meeting minutes and that sort of thing. It repeated repeated several times throughout the book.
Yeah, I should say it's not a book entirely about committees. I want people to read this. It's a book about covert action, spies, and secret statecraft. But there's a lot of fun stuff in there. A lot of wrangling.
Yes, absolutely. So since we mentioned, obviously, that the SOE was disbanded in 46, did any new organizations spring up to replace it in any way? Or was it an expansion of existing organizations as time went by, or something else entirely?
It was in SIS. The people, the capabilities were massively shrunk, but then moved to SIS, or MI6, as it's better known. And ever since then, it is MI6 who have had the scaled down capabilities for this kind of thing. There was no new CIA type organization springing out of the end of the war.
Okay, I see. And since you mentioned the CIA, and they did spring up not long after that, what was the level of post-war cooperation between the US and the UK? Were they kind of like in lockstep on everything, or did they have competing priorities between the two nations?
Well, the Brits were worried. The Brits thought that the Americans were a bit cavalier, if you like. The Brits are worried that the Americans are going around stoking up goodness knows what behind the Iron Curtain, fomenting rebellions left, right, and center, and that this wild approach could only lead to World War III. And Britain was much, much more cautious. So obviously there was a very close relationship between the two. And Britain had almost did a kind of a wily maneuver on the Americans. They gave the impression that they supported a lot of these American projects so they could be brought into the American confidence, so they could be part of these, you know, these joint discussions in order, the British hoped, to influence and constrain, be a calming presence on some of the more wild and reckless American projects. That was the plan. I mean, they were close, but I've always said that this Anglo-American relationship, you know, is often, particularly in Britain, banded as the special relationship. But on covert action, it was always pragmatic, close but pragmatic.
Okay, that's good to hear. And yeah, I mean, I think that some of their concerns were very well founded about cavalier activities that led to disaster, because that has certainly been a subject we've touched on here as well. So were there any times when, like, the UK stonewalled American actions, anything like that? Were like, hey, we're not going to be involved in this, or we strongly advise you not to do this, anything like that that you recall?
They tried particularly talking the Americans out of things like exile and emigre operations. The Brits thought they were dangerous, they were too leaky, but I don't think had a great deal of influence. The Brits started doing small-scale things around the Italian elections of 1948, but soon realized that the Americans were doing way more and were dwarfing British activity. And it's a gradual recognition, and it took a long time to realize it, that, you know, the relationship was becoming increasingly asymmetric. And it's really interesting, because coming out of the Second World War, the Americans, and I'm caricaturing slightly, but the Americans seem to think the Brits are really, really good at this. The Americans had the money, but the Brits had the brains and had the experience of covert warfare. Again, going back to before America was even a country. But it didn't take long for that cliche, that caricature, to be quite severely questioned. In fact, I would say as early as 48, 49, and the cooperation over Operation Valuable in Albania, when, you know, we know it in the history books as this joint operation to, in the history books again, to overthrow or detach the communist government in Albania. But actually, the Anglo-American cooperation there was full of tension. And the Americans soon realized that the Brits perhaps weren't all they were cracked up to be in the world of secret statecraft.
Okay, can you talk a little bit more in detail about that? Because I know that you devoted a pretty fair portion of your book to the Albania operations. And honestly, I did not know hardly anything about it at all until I read your book.
Yeah, well, it's an important milestone in post-war covert action, because it's widely regarded as the big liberation operation and a humongous failure, which spells the end of future liberation operations. And the Brits, as I said, were quite cautious about this, but things started to change around 1948 when the military had, as I mentioned earlier, got a seat at the table discussing these things, and so changed the dynamics a little bit. And also because the Soviets had expelled Yugoslavia from Cominform, which was the coordination body of communist parties in Europe. And this raised question marks about the cohesion of the Soviet bloc, and also, crucially, isolated Albania geographically. And so there's this potential for something slightly more dramatic, and the Brits were keen to explore this, but ultimately it was a failure. It was a colossal failure for a few reasons. I think first of all, the Brits never really knew what they wanted to achieve. We often recount this story in quite simplistic terms as one of failed liberation. But actually, what Britain wanted was to frustrate communist supply lines coming from Albania and feeding the Greek civil war. that's what the UK cared about. Hmm. And once the Greek Civil War ended, that rationale for meddling in Albania had gone. And so there was a lot of confusion in the files about this. They also lacked intelligence on the strength of resistance within Albania and on the strength of internal security. Communism, the Soviet Union was a much, much harder, tougher nut to crack than Nazi Germany. And I think they got spoiled. So in World War II, the Brits were able, obviously having cracked the Enigma code, were able to read Nazi communications and had a really impressive understanding of what the Nazis were up to. That was completely not the case when it came to international communism and the Soviet Union shortly afterwards. So, for example, Clement Attlee, the British post-war prime minister, great prime minister, not known as a great supporter of covert action or any particularly enthusiastic special operator, he, uncharacteristically perhaps, said, can't we bribe people in Albania? His quote was, are they not possibly for sale? And MI6 had to come back and say, look, I'm sorry, prime minister, but we don't know who to bribe. We haven't got enough intelligence on these people. And then the final reason why I think it went disastrously wrong, aside from not great cooperation between the Brits and the Americans, was leaky and factional emigres who were fighting each other often as much as they were fighting the Hoxha regime. And the Albania operation is also famous for being blown by Kim Philby, who needs no introduction for your listeners. But I think that's a mischaracterization. Now, clearly, Philby did plenty of awful things to earn his well-deserved reputation as a colossal traitor and hugely consequential traitor. But he didn't blow Albania. The first teams were known to the Soviet intelligence long before Philby had access to this and before Philby arrived in Washington. So I don't think we can pin this one on him. I think the Soviets did get wind of all this stuff and were ready and waiting as the first teams landed in Albania. But I think that was because of loose-lipped exiles and emigres rather on this occasion than Kim Philby.
Hmm. Okay. Were these guys, they weren't necessarily traitors or anything, were they just not practicing good operational security? These locals that were, or these refugees, like you said, that were recruited to go back to their home country, they were just not as tight-lipped as they should have been for the most part?
Exactly. They're not remotely seen as traitors. You know, these are brave people who wanted to remove the communist government, but they came from very different ideological backgrounds. You had the right wing, you had the royalist faction, and in many cases their tradecraft was quite poor. And MI6 is furious about their inability to keep secrets, frankly, and wants to move away from future operations working with exiles and emigres, which is a contrast to the CIA. The CIA are quite keen on this as a method to influence and meddle in foreign countries. So there's a clear divide there between the special relations.
Okay, I see. I believe during this same chapter you mentioned this strategy of pinprick effects. Is that correct?
Yeah. So what happens is the liberation of Albania, if indeed Britain ever actually seriously wanted to liberate Albania, and I personally doubt that they did, that dies a death because it's gone horribly, horribly wrong. Britain moved to a new strategy, which they called the pinprick approach. And put simply, it involved, actually I'll keep present tense because I think we still do it today. It involves small-scale testing and prodding and poking and chipping away, designed to exploit weaknesses and spread distrust and that kind of thing. So we're not talking about coups here. We're not talking about liberation. We're not talking about assassination. We're talking about low tempo, chipping away, spreading paranoia, exploiting weaknesses. And that started probably 1950-ish, and certainly continued through much of the Cold War. And if you read some British documents about things that are going on today, then there's a similar approach to, say, countering terrorism. You know, what are the fault lines? How can we chip away? How can we exploit divisions within extremist groups? So I think this is a British way, if you like, a British way in covert action, which has transcended the last 70 years.
Hmm. Okay, I see. Yeah, that's certainly a much more subtle approach, like you mentioned, than the American approach. And we've also seen the after effects of the American approach as well. So I can't really throw any stones at the British for taking a more subtle approach, certainly. And was this, do you think ultimately this was cost effective? I mean, did they get what they hoped to in many cases, or at least not lose very much? Or was this also a strategy that just kind of, you know, ran aground against the Soviets, you know, control of their home territory?
It's just so hard to know, because it didn't work in isolation. You know, this was designed as a force multiplying effect to aid the impact of overt means of foreign policy making. And it didn't work in isolation. It was about long-term disrupting, sowing confusion, spreading paranoia. I think that generally speaking, it did do those things and probably had slightly less blowback than hardcore coups and liberations and secret wars and that kind of thing. But it's very difficult to kind of prove tangible effects of these subtle long-term type approaches.
Okay, I've got it. So we've already covered the American interventions in Iran in the early 1950s, but can you tell me about British activities there and their own goals and perspective on what was happening there in the early 1950s?
It's funny because we remember Iran, the coup in Iran, summer 53, as an American covert action, one of the most famous CIA covert actions, when actually in reality, it was a joint Anglo-American covert action. And particularly importantly, it was one which was begun by the Brits almost 2 years earlier. It was Britain who got the ball rolling on the removal of Mossadegh. And the reason why was Mossadegh nationalized Iranian oil. Britain was, to put it bluntly, pretty skint after Second World War, and the British Treasury needed the money from the Anglo-Iranian oil corporation. And suddenly, you know, Mossadegh took it away. So as early as autumn 1951, way before the Americans were remotely interested in this, it was Britain which was deliberately trying to create a climate conducive to regime change through things like subversion, through bribery, through widespread propaganda, through mobilizing opposition to Mossadegh in places like the bazaars. And Mossadegh got wind of this. He knew exactly what Britain was up to, and he expelled all UK diplomats in October 1952, including the MI6 station out there. And around this time, Britain is courting America. It's saying, please, America, come on board and join us. And actually, the US is very reluctant to do so until Eisenhower comes in and is slightly more keen on this sort of thing than Truman. But even then, the Brits are having to play the communist card, deliberately play up the communist card to try to entice the Americans to get involved. They also deliberately play up the analogy of, well, what if the Venezuelans nationalize their oil? What if the Saudi Arabians or the Iraqis nationalize their oil? What would you do, America? This is dangerous. So the Brits are actively trying, sometimes slightly misleadingly, to bring the Americans on board. And eventually, of course, the Americans do come on board using British networks and assets, it should be said. So this was very much an Anglo-American operation, and one which famously, or perhaps infamously, resulted in the removal of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953.
Yeah, quite a turning point in the Middle East and really in 20th century geopolitics as well, certainly. And I know that there was... Go ahead.
No, go on.
So I know that there was certainly a lot of other activities and a lot of hot spots in the Middle East as well. I think that, if I recall from your book correctly, Nasser in Egypt was also kind of an operational target. Not for assassination necessarily, but he became a target for SIS at some point?
Oh, he did. NASA. He was the kind of public enemy number one of Anthony Eden, the British Prime Minister of the 1950s. His crime, if you like, in Eden's mind, was he was an ardent nationalist. Worse than that, he espoused pan-Arabic nationalism. So he was trying to kind of not just whip up nationalism in Egypt, but also export this across the region and push British interests, British involvement and influence out of the Middle East. And then, of course, he nationalized the Suez Canal. And the Brits were desperate to remove him. They planned, well, there's a huge propaganda campaign against him. There were plots of coups, where they're using Egyptian dissidents, using Muslim Brotherhood, they were tapping up. They even tapped up one of the guys from Albania, the self-declared king of Albania, King Zog. They even at one point had a discussion with him about becoming a king of Egypt. So they were trying all sorts of things to get rid of Nasser. And then most famously of all, they were also talking about assassination.
Yeah, I know that I didn't really know too much about it before I read your book, but the whole incident with them taking control of the Suez actually went really poorly for Britain and France in the end. So how did things work out with the Suez crisis and Nasser in the end? I mean, did all of these efforts come to fruition or no?
No, Nasser very much stayed in power. Britain and France colluded with Israel to create a pretext for the Suez War in 1956, which ultimately went horribly wrong when essentially the Americans put pressure on the Brits to put an end to it. And it's widely regarded as one of those key moments in 20th century history, showing the turning of the tide in not just in the Middle East, but in global politics more widely, when Britain is no longer the world superpower, is giving up that place to the Americans, much to the frustration of many British imperialists in Whitehall.
Yeah, certainly. I can see how that would be very, very upsetting for a lot of people in that establishment, to say the least.
Yeah, it was. And so they came up with all sorts of different schemes to try to maintain British influence. And one of my key arguments in the book is that Britain turned to the Hidden Hand, turned to MI6, in order to plug that gap between perceived responsibilities of being a world power, but not having the actual clout to physically back it up with money or military resources or whatever. So they turned to secret statecraft to try to plug that gap. But it didn't. I mean, they tried. There was lots of talk about assassinating Nasser in particular, none of which your listeners will know came to fruition. But that was Britain's slightly scaled down version, Castro moment, if you like. You know, we're all very familiar with the outlandish plots and ploys to try and kill Castro over the years.
Oh yes.
And this was our version, involving nerve gas, involving poison darts, injecting Nasser's favorite chocolates with poison, sabotaging his razor so it exploded, and even hiring hitmen from his doctor to the Muslim Brotherhood to mercenaries to the SAS. But ultimately, it all failed.
Oh my gosh. So were these mostly plots that were considered but rejected, or did his security people put a stop to a lot of these while they were actually ongoing?
It's so hard to know, because some of it was plans which just got left on the cutting room floor, if you like. We know, or we think we know, that the poison chocolates did get sent off to Egypt, but clearly never reached their targets, or if they did, they failed. So that clearly didn't work. But we also know there was division at the top. So we know that GCHQ, Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency, opposed doing this. They worried that Nasser would be made a martyr if he died. We know that the incoming MI6 chief, a guy called Dick White, opposed assassination operations. We also know that the foreign secretary, a guy called Selwyn Lloyd, opposed assassination. But it was the prime minister, Anthony Eden, who was really pushing this. And the CIA itself were aware. There was a running joke throughout 1956 that the CIA would have to restrain Anthony Eden physically to keep him from going down to Cairo to shoot NASA himself, is a line that I got from CIA files.
Oh my goodness.
It's hard to know exactly, you know, how far these different operations got. But the ultimate, you know, truth is they failed.
Every day, you're under attack, whether you realize it or not. Your digital devices contain your entire life, your finances, your conversations with friends and family, your interests, and even your movements. And all of that is vulnerable to an ever-expanding class of criminals, scam artists, hackers, and even governments. You don't want to leave your data security entirely in the hands of your ISP, or anyone else for that matter. It's up to you to protect yourself using a multi-layered defense strategy. Cylent offers you the protection you need to keep your data and devices secure from wireless threats. Their multi-shield technology blocks cellular signals, GPS, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, EMP, RFID, NFC, and more. Cylent's lineup includes everything from signal-blocking wallets all the way up to 40 cubic liter Faraday duffel bags. When you're geared up with Cylent, you'll be truly disconnected, undetectable, untraceable, and unhackable. And you can now use the discount code SPYCRAFT101 to save 10% off your order from Cylent. Find them at slnt.com. That's slnt.com. Yeah. So at that point, did they kind of move on, or was there just a pivot to a different strategy of like influence or blackmail or bribery or something like that in Egypt? Like, how did they continue to try to impact or influence events there?
Yeah, they carried on. The blackmail, the influence, the propaganda never went away. It was just working alongside the assassination. So up to, you know, through 57, 58, they're still thinking about coups. They're still launching a huge propaganda campaign through the 1960s, you know, early 1960s. NASA is still very much in the line of fire for Britain's forgers. The team's creating fake groups to spread propaganda, to smear NASA across the Middle East. It's all still there. He is still very much public enemy number one.
Hmm. Okay. So I do want to ask you also about Oman, because I think that things went a lot better there compared to many other areas during that time period. Can you talk a little bit about operations in Oman?
There was a few small-scale special operations supporting the Omani government against rebels and uprising. And I think that is a slightly different scenario, hence why it's not, you know, regarded as an abject failure. Because it's about supporting people who want them to be there. You know, we're not talking about coups, we're not talking about trying to overthrow governments. And I think that the conditions for success were slightly more favorable than, say, at the same time Britain was trying to, you know, launch coups to overthrow communist regimes or leftist regimes in places like Syria, which were much more difficult. So they were pushing forces in the right direction, I think, in Oman compared to elsewhere in the Middle East.
Okay. That does make more sense. Yeah, it was a very different scenario, like you mentioned, and there was a lot of SAS involvement there as well, which I think has been covered in a number of places, including your book as well. But that does seem like one of the bright spots during that period anyway.
Yeah, it was more SAS, wasn't it, than MI6. And yeah, I think it's a different type of operation, if you like. Whereas the coups in places like Syria are particularly difficult. You know, Britain lacked really good intelligence on the ground. Britain was trying to coordinate between loads of different parties, whether it's, you know, bringing the Americans in again. There was one scheme they were trying to coordinate between the Americans, the Jordanians, the Iraqis, the Israelis. And unsurprisingly, this very, very delicate diplomacy in tears, whereas, you know, cooperating more bilaterally with the Omanis was far more favorable conditions.
Right. That makes perfect sense. So on another subject, I know that at this time, Britain still had a few colonies spread around the world. And was SIS involved there, or was that considered more of like a internal situation that was left to other organizations?
Yeah, it was a thorny problem, this one. There was a longstanding position where MI6 had no mandates in British colonies. These are seen as domestic interior populations. They're part of the British Empire. They are the domain of MI5, which is Britain's domestic intelligence agency. And MI6 had no place operating in them, and certainly had no place meddling, manipulating, and subverting imperial populations. Not only was it kind of it was improper, it was unethical, and it was anti-British. Now this starts to be challenged, particularly as colonies move towards independence, towards the Commonwealth. But even then, this divide still holds. There are many Commonwealth ministers and senior officials who were adamant that MI6 had no role to play in Commonwealth territories, and were even very reluctant to allow MI6 to operate from Commonwealth territories to cross borders and go into foreign countries. There was a lot of tension and friction about this point.
I wouldn't have expected that, honestly. I mean, it's your territory, so you should use it to your advantage on the world stage, is what I would think, but that is surprising.
Well, I guess the counter is it was British territory, and therefore Britain didn't have to do underhand stuff. So, for example, when British Guyana was kicking off in the 1950s, I think it was, before the famous CIA operations, what did Britain do to counter this? They changed the constitution, because Britain could, because it was a colony. So I think there's an argument to get to say that you don't need to do covert action in your colonies, because you can just, go pretty, pretty overt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no need for covert activities when you are the rule of law and you can just do whatever you want. So yeah, don't mention changing the constitution too loudly here in the United States, please. That's going to cost a lot of
money. No comment.
Yeah. So I want to move forward a little bit to the 70s and the 80s as well. What was the involvement in Northern Ireland? Because I know we already mentioned thorny conflicts, and that's about as thorny as it gets from my understanding.
Totally. This is a really thorny, thorny conflict. And it creates, talking of the colony issue, Britain didn't want to be, struggled with the idea of doing covert action on its own territory. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, and there was serious controversy about subverting, manipulating, going underhand on the streets of the UK against British citizens, essentially. And so this was a particularly thorny issue. And whereas the American definition of covert action, it's about doing stuff overseas. America, the CIA, does not operate domestically. This broke down in Northern Ireland. And to be honest, a little bit before Britain has engaged domestically, using what we would consider as covert action. But in Northern Ireland, they have this whole debate. They tried to square it. They tried to say, right, how can we justify the Foreign Office propaganda getting involved in Belfast? And so you can see all of the Olympic level gymnastics, linguistic gymnastics going on, conceptual gymnastics. They were saying, they are linked to the communists. There's a bit of subversion going on, so that can justify propaganda. And the most ridiculous one was, they're Catholic, they're linked to the Vatican. The Vatican's a foreign state, so let's get involved. So you can see some quite torturous thought processes going on.
Oh my God.
In order to justify some of these propaganda operations.
It's hard to imagine being in the room when somebody brings that up verbally for the first time. The Vatican is a foreign power.
They relied on that. They relied on that to justify propaganda efforts against people in the United Kingdom. And we're talking about a range of operations which have recently been have been declassified. And going back to that pinprick approach we were talking about earlier, the aim of these propaganda operations was to exploit disagreements and exploit rivalries within extremist groups, to sow confusion, to sow paranoia, and exploit these pre-existing tensions. So, for example, there was one operation where they planned to set the various wings of the IRA against each other. They were spreading rumors that the official IRA were planning to assassinate leadership in the provisional IRA, and then kind of sit back and watch the two organizations turn on each other. This was the kind of professional antagonism that the British covert operations were involved in.
Yeah, I have to say, I think the ultimate effect of that was very effective. And the reason I say that is just a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed a former IRA member. And, you know, quite frankly, he was in awe of British intelligence from his own experience there. And he strongly believed that the highest echelons of IRA leadership was totally compromised by British intelligence. I don't think that he had any, you know, hard evidence of that, but he had very strong suspicions of it, you know, dating back 40 years, essentially. And he believed that ultimately, you know, the SIS was pulling the strings of everything that went on in Northern Ireland the whole time. That was kind of what I walked away from that interview with. And I'm not sure how true that is, but that was certainly his impression after being deeply involved for many years.
Well, it's really interesting you say that, because that was the, you know, one of the goals of covert operations was to induce paranoia and was to induce, it was almost, I think of it as administrative sabotage. You know, it's designed to sabotage the smooth running of terrorist organizations, of adversaries, of hostile foreign states. The aim is just to throw some grit into the machine. And whether or not Britain did compromise the entire upper echelons of the IRA, I do not know. But the fact that they created that impression, making everyone think that everyone else was a, you know, compromised or was a foreign spy or was a traitor, that induces paranoia. That messes up your counterintelligence regime. It creates purges. It creates all sorts of problems, which is very, very disruptive when you're trying to run your own campaign, whether as a foreign state or as a terrorist group or whatever. So I think, you know, that in itself demonstrates the impact of some of these covert operations. Whether or not the reality is true, the impact that those, you know, that these operations had, because they were designed to do exactly that, to sow that level of distrust.
Yeah, well, they were certainly effective in that case, in my opinion, after talking to one of the people who was there at the time. So very impressive. Even if they did not have that level of access and penetration that they wanted, they certainly created that impression.
Interesting. Yeah, I think what was probably more important from a material perspective was the clandestine diplomacy that was going on behind closed doors between various rebel groups and the British state. I think that was really important. But it's fascinating to hear the impact of the propaganda.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about that diplomacy? I mean, I think it is pretty normal for adversaries to kind of keep some sort of open channel of communication, but how was it affected during the Troubles?
Yeah, there were back channels between the Irish nationalist leadership and MI6 that were, you know, were very secret, going through intermediaries sometimes, but which were ultimately, I think, quite important in bringing about the Good Friday Agreement. You know, this is a really important part of intelligence work, which often doesn't get much discussion, whether in popular literature or in academic research. We don't talk much about clandestine diplomacy, covert diplomacy, but it's a thing that the intelligence agencies do from MI6 through to Mossad. And if there's anyone out there wanting to think of a cool PhD topic, there's one right there.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to ask you, at what point during the Troubles did Margaret Thatcher become prime minister? Because I understand that that was another major change in how covert activities were conducted once she was in charge.
Yeah, she comes in, she's in charge for the whole of the 1980s and is much more, shall we say, embracing the world of special forces and intelligence. She She loves this stuff. She thinks it can make a huge difference. And from Northern Ireland through to Afghanistan, she is frustrated. She's sick and tired of what she called the wets in the Foreign Office, who were just so cautious and didn't want to do anything, and embraced anybody that was up for a good covert fight. And we see the Special Forces taking on an increased role in Northern Ireland in the 1980s, whereas in the 1970s it was much more amateurish, and there were some very dodgy and controversial operations involving, which ended up being accused of being undercover shoot-to-kill operation in the 1970s. Thatcher professionalized some of this in the 80s and embraced, I think it's fair to say, embraced the world of the SAS and MI6 all the way through from Northern Ireland to Afghanistan.
Okay, I see. So since you mentioned Afghanistan, actually, that was where I wanted to go with this next. What was the American involvement in Afghanistan during the Russian occupation is pretty well known, but what was the role that British covert action played during that conflict?
I love this. This is another great example of a famous covert action, which is told almost universally through the American prison. This is America sponsoring the Mujahideen, Hollywood films made about it, when in reality, there are loads of states involved. America clearly plays the dominant role. I don't want to undermine that. But obviously Pakistan, very, very famously and very heavily involved. The French, I think the Chinese were involved at one point, the Egyptians. And then the Brits were also involved. And SIS, MI6 worked quite closely with the CIA because MI6 knew the region pretty well and knew some of the key players better than the CIA did because of Britain's longstanding relationships and presence in that part of the world. MI6 spread a lot of propaganda, spreading the word about Soviet occupation and the strength and the potency and the legitimacy of the rebels. The Brits played a coordinating role, encouraging various non-aligned countries and the Muslim world to support the resistance. And on a more practical level, more direct level, if you like, as the conflict continued, MI6 and Special Forces got involved in training certain rebel fighters and even helped facilitate the sabotage of fuel supplies. There was a lovely passage in a book by a former Saudi intelligence chief that came out a couple of years ago. Again, talking about the internationalization of these covert actions, the Saudis put in loads of money into this. And he told a story of how the British intelligence supplied boron carbide powder to Special Forces, who in turn worked with local resistance forces to inject this powder into fuel pipelines and also to disguise it as charcoal and somehow get it into fuel tanks inside Soviet bases. And that this powder managed to, well, it caused engines to seize up. The Saudi intelligence chief actually said this sabotage, in which MI6 was closely involved, had a really big impact on the success of the covert action. He said, I think more so than the more famous Stinger missiles that the Americans were sending by the mid 1980s. But I think what's important to note here then is that this is these big covert actions involve lots of countries, and Britain, as ever, is involved.
That's amazing. I don't think I even knew about that boron carbide story. I'm going to have to look that up again. I might have seen it in the book, but I just, that's new to me for some reason. But, it's funny you mentioned how America is always the public face of this kind of stuff. When they talk about the unseen hand, they're not referring to American activities because our hand is usually seen pretty quickly in everything, especially when we make a Rambo movie out of it right afterwards, of course, as well. But yeah, it's so gratifying to see the British take such a much subtler approach to these kind of things. But I guess you guys have centuries of experience and we have decades of it on our side of the ocean.
Oh, you say that. You guys have been doing it since the days of Washington, to be fair. You're racking up
the
experience.
Good. Yeah, he was one in a million, that's for sure. I still haven't actually done an episode about him, but he is certainly due one as well. But he was quite a guy for many reasons, certainly. So, yeah, we all know ultimately how things went in Afghanistan. And I do want to kind of move into the modern era here. So once, you know, around 1991, you know, everything is changing drastically. Of course, the Cold War is coming to an end. What does that mean for British covert action? Do they go in search of new targets, or do they kind of spool down just like at the end of World War II?
Yeah, it means the same as it does for us as it did for the Americans. Budget cuts and existential crises. You have people saying, do we still need intelligence in this brave new world? Do we still need covert action? And MI6 saw a big, you know, big cuts to their budget, to their personnel. But ultimately, we see a diversification of activities with a wider range of threats to disrupt, from, you know, operations in the wars of the former Yugoslavia to countering into weapons proliferation, WMD proliferation, to disrupting organized crime, terrorism. I mean, we see a big diversification of covert actions. And again, it's quite low level. It's about, you know, I think this is the British way. It's about disrupting. And we saw a lot of that going on, I think, in the 1990s, but obviously on a much smaller scale compared to the height of the Cold War.
Sure. So in your estimation, do you think that the cuts and the changes that were made like post-1991, were they, and you know, we have the benefit of hindsight now, but were they appropriate at the time, or was there way too much of a kind of rest on your laurels at the end of the Cold War kind of mentality going on, and, you know, which ultimately led to people being caught unawares?
Yeah, probably the latter. I think we let go, the Brits, the Americans, let a lot of people go, a lot of Russian experts go. And then, you know, fast forward, what are we now? 20-odd, 30-odd years later, and Russia is back on the intelligence agenda. You know, Western intelligence maybe doesn't have the depth and long-term institutional memory that it could have done. So I think it was probably premature. But there's also a question of knowledge and sources around this particular decade, which I find absolutely fascinating. And it's the same here as it is for the Americans. You know, we have lots of documents about, particularly Americans, have lots of documents about the Cold War, 1980s, Afghanistan, Poland. Again, there's lots of stuff out there. And then we have lots of documents post-2001, because there are myriad inquiries into 9/11 and the War on Terror. 1990s just becomes this black hole. And I find it quite striking, even reading histories of US covert action, you know, Locke Johnson's recent book, great book, 1990s is glossed over. And not just because I think there was less going on, although there was less going on, but because it's weirdly become a source black hole, sandwiched between archival declassifications and the world of public inquiries.
That is intriguing for sure.
I'd love to know more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, U.S. intelligence and military capabilities kind of grew tremendously after the September 11th attacks in 2001. Was there a similar rapid expansion for British capabilities as well?
Yeah, there was. I mean, not to the same level, extent, to volume and tempo as America, particularly in terms of special forces. But clearly, this was a big priority for the British security and intelligence establishments. Both MI6, GCHQ and MI5 operating domestically were keen to expand, gather more resources, more capabilities, and also more personnel able to speak languages which hadn't been prioritized for a number of years because of, you know, the Cold War context. So there was a quick building up of capabilities, but nothing compared to the scale of the Americans.
Yeah, certainly. We like to go all in on that kind of thing. and actually, I don't really know this about Britain, but, you know, we certainly have an enormous military industrial complex here, just like I believe it was Eisenhower who first described it. But are there similar, like, massive corporations that kind of, you know, wag the dog a little bit in the United Kingdom as well?
Nah, to be honest, not to the same extent. We don't, I don't know. I would say it's a very scaled down version of what you guys have. We don't have anything on the same scale.
Probably for the best. I mean, I'll tell you just from a personal perspective. If you go through the subway station under the Pentagon in Northern Virginia,
they have advertisements for the F-35 and whatever the brand new land vehicle is, you know, the flavor of the month or something like that. You know, they're just trying to constantly impact and influence government procurement and government operations and that sort of thing. It's really amazing the level of kind of, I guess you could say, government penetration of all these companies, honestly. But I was wondering, I was very curious if that kind of thing exists in the United Kingdom, but I guess not.
Well, I've seen those billboards. They are quite striking. And the fact that I found them quite so striking probably suggests that we don't have anything comparable back here. And there was a report out a couple of weeks ago severely criticizing British defense procurement practices. It's become a bit of a running theme in British defense circles about our inability to procure things at a decent price and in a decent time frame. It's a very different context, I think, compared to what the Americans are used to.
Okay, yeah, that's good to know. Sounds like you have a head screwed on right there. So, Rory, I am curious. I think basically because of the, you know, technological leaps that we've had in the past few years, but I understand from your book that the GCHQ has taken a lot more of a lead in a lot of operations in recent years. Can you talk about their impact and what they do a little bit?
Yeah, very much so. Britain has never had such a narrowly defined approach to covert action as the Americans. We've always had this approach where whichever agency or actor is the most valuable or impactful for that particular context is the one that will lead it. So, you know, MI6 traditionally has done the bulk of this stuff. The Foreign Office have done covert action, I mean, in terms of black propaganda in the Cold War. And now recently we've seen the rise of GCHQ from intelligence gatherers, which is and remains their biggest role, to get involved in the world of offensive cyber. This has recently been avowed that GCHQ, working closely with the Ministry of Defense and with MI6, has been doing things like disrupting hostile foreign propaganda, has been disrupting terrorist group propaganda and terrorist group capabilities, has even been messing with terrorist communications. Again, it's kind of a theme of our discussion to try to exacerbate tensions between terrorist groups and to exacerbate confusion and divisions and all this kind of stuff. They call it these days, they call it effects operations, online effects operations, lowering the adversary's confidence in his or her communications platforms, spreading that paranoia, spreading that distrust, spreading that confusion. We're now seeing that done by GCHQ because it involves manipulating online platforms.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it sounds like you guys certainly have a huge amount of experience, hard-won experience in those realms. So I would imagine that there have been quite a few successes in that area in recent years.
Yeah, they've talked about the successes in very generic terms, talking about operations against ISIS to take down propaganda sites, to lock terrorists out from their computer systems, for example. I mean, these things get briefed to the press. But it's it's the same thing that MI6 were doing back in the 1940s, 1950s. And that's what I find, as a historian, find so fascinating. The platforms change, the technologies change, but the fundamental principles of meddling, sowing distrust, the pinprick approach, cognitive effects, they are timeless.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So Rory, I'm curious, just for you personally, out of all the research you've done, is there any particular event or operation, something like that, that you are the most curious about, the one that you most want to learn anything you can about if it's ever declassified or unearthed somehow?
Well, you know what I'm really intrigued about? And it's not from my own research, but it's the Nord Stream 2 pipeline stuff from whenever was a couple of years ago. And we've read so many contradictory reports about, you know, who was behind it. And do you know what I just find absolutely fascinating? That in this world of open source investigative journalism, of mass data, everyone's got a smartphone, it's so hard to keep secrets now. The fact that there's, you know, still a bit of discussion about who could have been behind it and how it worked, with competing accounts coming from different credible newspaper organizations, I just find that really, really interesting. And I'm very curious as to what really happened there.
Absolutely. I've read a little bit about that. I haven't dove too deep into it yet, honestly, but it's also because it's not clear at all. Like, I haven't seen a definitive answer or a person, you know, even that I could go to and ask, you know, for a, kind of a step-by-step about what happened, but I have to wonder if one of those competing theories is 100% accurate and it's just kind of been, you know, swamped by all of the deluge of information out there, or if, you know, nobody really has the right answer except the people that were directly involved themselves. I mean, it's got to be one or the other, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what I find really, really fascinating is how my little pet theory, not about this particular operation, but the covert actions, you know, are going to continue in this age of unsecrecy, in this age of openness. It's incredibly hard to operate clandestinely in 2023, but it's going to continue. And I think the confusion around Nord Stream illustrates that, I think, quite neatly.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I have to wonder how long it will be before the truth on that comes out, or if we'll at least decide that one of the competing theories is the true one there. So it's hard to say, but this is all such a waiting game, just like you've been waiting, you know, decades and decades for the truth to come out about some of the stuff that you've written about, I'm sure.
Well, hopefully it'll come out before the equivalence of me waiting for the 1950s. I'll be long dead.
Yeah, with all the sensors and everything that are available now, I think that the information is out there somewhere, and whether it's been pieced together correctly yet or not, it's hard to say. But, you know, maybe we'll get some sort of in-depth report from Bellingcat, or maybe it will be some other organization one day that will kind of tell us what happened there. But yeah, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Well, I'll be reading it with interest whenever it comes out. Yeah,
absolutely. So will I. So wonderful. This has been a great talk, Roy. I really appreciate it. Are you working on another book right now, or are you just teaching at the moment, or what?
Well, I should plug that the US version of our book, Secret Royals, which is called Crown, Cloak and Dagger, is coming out in the US on the 1st of September. It's all about the relationship between the British monarchy and the intelligence services, going back from Victoria all the way to Queen Elizabeth II. That's coming out in the US September. And then the next project I'm working on right now, which I am loving, is a history of Britain's super secretive propagandists who were behind all of our fakes and our forgeries in the Cold War. And this is one of those very rare things where we've got all the operational detail. So I'm going right into the nitty-gritty to give the blow-by-blow accounts of how the UK did its forgeries and its most blackest of black propaganda operations. And I'm thoroughly enjoying writing it.
Fantastic. I'm really looking forward to that. Do you have a time frame for that as well, or is that still off in the, you know, the far future?
Fingers crossed, contract's about to be signed and with delivery of 2025, which, to be fair, is a long way away, but I'm excited about it.
Great. Well, I hope to have you back on for that one as well then in a couple of years. That'd be wonderful, because that sounds like exactly the kind of book that I like to dive into as well. But I'll let you do all the footwork for me and just put together a nice summary so I can read it. Great. Well, thank you so much, Roy. So the book, for those of you who want to pick it up, and, you know, we've barely scratched the surface of it over the past hour, honestly, but the book is called Disrupt and Deny: Spies, Special Forces, and the Secret Pursuit of British Foreign Policy by Rory Cormack. So make sure you pick it up. It's very, very thorough. It goes into close to 70 years, probably, of covert action, and just everything that can be publicly known about it right now, you're probably going to find in that book. So it was a very, very impressive and interesting read, and a great reference for so many different events. And Rory, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Justin. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Do you have a public social media or anything like that for anybody who wants to connect with you after this discussion?
I'm on Twitter, or X, or whatever the heck it's called these days, at Rory Cormack, RoryCormac.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. I'll look you up there. I'm not sure if we're connected on there yet or not, since I just emailed you through the school, but I will look. And if we're not, we certainly will be in a few minutes.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Rory. Take care.
Thank you very much, Justin. You too.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around, because there's lots more to come.
Disclaimer: this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.